Protest Songbook, Protest in Music and Artistic Practice. I'm Dominic Hislop. I'm an artist from Scotland, based in Berlin. And this is a radio programme documenting a project initiated in 2003 with Hungarian artist Miklos Erhardt under the group name Big Hope. For as long as I can remember, I've had a fairly equally balanced interest in music and visual art. This has not only involved the reception, but also the consistent creation of works in both these mediums. My initial interest in visual art gave privilege to aesthetics and emotional expression over concepts and content. However, for a long time, a central element of both the art I appreciate and the art I make has been an attempt to explore the possibilities of art as a form of social engagement, protest, and activism. By contrast, with music, whereas songs do exist that have impressed me in a political sense, the majority of what I listen to and write as my own compositions contains a much stronger element of emotional expression. This is therefore the oral equivalent of an expressionistic use of aesthetics, something I wouldn't consider in my own visual art practice. It was this contradiction between the quite different criteria involved in my approach to and appreciation of these two creative mediums that formed the basis of my interest in investigating music's relationship with politics and comparing it with that of visual art and politics. In response to an invitation to exhibit at a gallery called Rotor in Graz, Austria, in July of 2003, Hungarian artist Erhard Miklos and myself, Dominic Hislop, collaborated under the group name Big Hope on a participative and performative project titled The Protest Songbook, which would seek to address some of the interests that I just outlined. In an attempt to gather instances of when and how music and political protest have combined, and opinions about the success of this union, an open invitation was sent out by email in which potential contributors were asked to suggest a song that had resonated with them in a political sense at some point in their lives and to write some brief statement giving the background for their choice. The responses gathered were rich and varied. Reasons for the political nature of the music were stated as being conveyed through lyrical content, both overtly and with subtlety, the attitude of the artist, the production of the music, or the relevance of the song to a particular period or event. In some instances, these sentiments captured and reaffirmed the contributor's own existing views, but in others they provided a catalyst for a change in opinions or behaviour. Some songs were said to have had an effect on raising awareness, whilst others provided a rallying cry, useful for singing at demonstrations or a call to action. All the contributions were collated in an online archive of protest songs. That can be found at www.bighope.hu/protestsongs. That's all one word. And also presented on placards in an installation at the Rotor Gallery. A few of them were played on acoustic guitars by Miklos and myself on the streets of Graz during the time of the exhibition. Four interviews, forming a more discursive element to the presentation, were also conducted with various artists, musicians and activists, each with a particular interest in the topic. Martha Rossler, a New York-based visual artist, Elio Gilardi, a Turin-based coordinator of the creative group within the political activist group Torino Disobbediente, Ross Birrell, a Glasgow-based visual artist and writer, and sometimes musician, and Jeff Farina, Rhode Island-based singer-songwriter. So, I'd like to start by going straight to those interviews. And the first one is with Martha Rossler. Martha Rossler is a New York-based artist who has engaged with social and political issues in her work since the late 1960s. The following interview was conducted on a telephone line, and unfortunately, the quality isn't so great, but I hope you can make something out of it. Could you tell us about some song that for you either encapsulates or has had an influence on forming some of your political views?
When I was a young teenager, I think the things that interested me were hearing Pete Seeger sing Peat Bog Soldiers taught me something about history and made me very curious about oppression in Europe before my lifetime.
One day we will cry rejoicing, homeland dear, you're mine at last. Then will the Peat Bog Soldiers march no more with their spades to the moon.
And in the 80s, I was very affected by Bob Marley's Get Up, Stand Up, which represented the idea of continuing struggle. It emanated from a place other than my own, but it was pretty much a universal song, and I still think Bob Marley is fantastic, and it's a fantastic song. So.
Stand up! Stand up for your rights! Get up! Stand up! Stand up for your rights! Get up! Stand up! Don't give up the fight!
Those are the ones that I would think about. I even used a clip from it in a piece that I did. It's the piece is not so important. It was the song, but I did do a piece in I guess it was 1980. I think this is what I used it for. A piece called On the Cusp of the 80s that was about resistance. And so it was a piece from 79 to 81. It was a performance that I sort of put together a collage of sounds on the soundtrack, and that was one of the pieces.
Was that something new for you to be working with music that had political content as well as the visuals?
Well, I hadn't done it a lot, but I had done it a little bit. For another work, I had used a little piece of Marianne Faithfull's Broken English, which is not so clearly political as Get Up, Stand Up by Bob Marley.
I'd like to ask you about the connection between politics and art and politics and music. So it's clear from your own work that politics has an important role in visual art, but I'm wondering whether you feel it has an equally important place in music.
I would not presume to say what kind of music people should be making, but I also tend toward music that is not directly political. I think the thing to remember is that music is more often nonverbal than verbal in its direct address to people, and that music is more than lyrics. I don't know if I'm saying that properly, but I think the meaning of music for human beings really transcends the rational and therefore the political. Music and dance are among the most basic uniters of human beings from the earliest days of our existence as a species, so there's nothing more important than music.
Is it important for you that art should include reflections or engagement with social and political issues?
Well, it's certainly important for me, but I'm not a cop, so I don't believe in making rules for everybody. I mean, you know, I started as a painter, and I have great sympathies for people who are not interested in incorporating social engagement in whatever form in their work. Of course, everyone does, no matter what, but if people feel that what their work is about is something else, I think the world is richer for it.
I remember reading that during the Vietnam War, you decided that you had to get involved somehow and decided to stop making art because it wasn't contributing towards the movement opposed to the war. You downed your paintbrushes to do a different kind of creative act, which you didn't consider to be art at the time, but it later became recognised in the art world as part of your overall body of work. I'm just wondering whether your view of your role as an artist when involved in a creative activism has changed since then.
Well, now I don't worry so much about it. At the time, because I was deeply involved in making abstract paintings, of course, I had to make a decision. And as you say, it was, in effect, to step outside my identity as an artist and have another kind of practice. And I remember thinking, you know, if I had to choose between calling myself an artist or some political activist at this point, I would have to say political activist, because this is an urgent task. And I just had to stop going into the studio because I felt so guilty continuing to paint. Now I do a number of different kinds of things, none of which involve abstraction. So I consider that the work I do is always political, in my opinion, or I should say, you know, socially engaged, but it ranges from directly agitational to much more, I would say, structural in its look at the meaning of social beliefs and social products, social constructions, and things like that. And I'm thinking particularly of things relating to, for example, the built environment, airports, modes of travel, housing, and so on, which have a directly political dimension sometimes, but often speak through their architecture in muted tones about social assumptions and social obligations and or lack of obligations.
So would you say it's less directly engaged than it was before?
No, I wouldn't say that. I'd say that some of my work is less directly engaged with urgent tasks, but others of it is just as agitational or even, if you will, propagandistic, though, of course, that's always a negative term, as it's always been. Just I have somewhat of a wider practice, since none of it involves painting now.
When the huge mass mobilizations and taking to the streets were unable to stop the war in Iraq, do you feel, as you did at the time of the Vietnam War, that we're in another situation that requires more urgent action than engaging in traditional art practices?
Well, people are not taking to the streets right now, and yet I would still say this is an urgent situation, I think. But the urgency is built in ever since the sudden upsurge of anti-corporate globalization in Seattle in 1999 and all the subsequent European versions of the same multitudinous rejection, and the development of the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil, there is a worldwide sentiment, obviously, for a different mode of operating and against what we can now clearly call American neo-imperialism, since America has literally embraced the term imperialism itself at its governmental and policy level. So I think it's an urgent moment, but it's not a crisis point. It's just below crisis point, and we can see that crises flare up, partly exacerbated by the worldwide loosely organized terror campaign against the United States and its allies that precipitated the full press of imperial plans that the Bush administration is engaging in.
How do you feel that a sense of hope about having an impact on current political developments can be maintained?
Well, you know, I think it's really important that people get out of the habit of expecting instant results. Political struggle is not like a football match where you win a number of points and then you've won. It's something that is strategically carried out in many different locations and with different tactics, and it goes on and on until things change, the course of struggle is affected, and hopefully, you know, we create a better world. But I'd like to go back to something you said earlier, which is that it was a war that we were unable to stop. Yes, that's completely true. But I think that it was a war whose course was affected very powerfully by the millions of people who stood in the street in February and March. And I also think that at the moment it is having a severe effect on the Blair government, and there's a crisis of credibility not only in England, but at a lower level in the United States about the reasons for going to war. So I think the battle carries on.
I remember hearing about the Whitney Biennial in 1993 as an important event in the United States which brought to the forefront of art discourse, art practices that had been working in a more marginal way with political issues for some time. There's been a trend in Europe, at least over recent years, for artists to work collaboratively in longer-term documentary projects, which focus on issues of social justice, And some of these projects seem to draw on the approaches that came to light at the time of that Whitney show. How has the role of politically engaged art in mainstream art discourse developed in the US since that time?
I don't know that I would credit the Whitney Biennale of 93 for doing anything other than reflecting a certain politicized practice that was developing. And in fact, the director of the museum wound up, in effect, losing his job over that because of the severe attacks from the right wing about the nature of the Biennale. That discouraged a lot of artists who wanted to make it big in the market, who withdrew from making any direct kind of statement or showing any kind of direct political engagement. But at the same time, just as in Europe, there's lots of young artists who really have wanted to get involved in projects that relate to the real world and, as you say, have formed groups, collectives, and loose associations that draw them into working on projects that relate to social governance, social justice, and so on, you know, questions that should occupy every citizen, but the whole concept of citizenship in America is severely eroded.
With an increasing documentary tendency, some long-term communicative art projects result in a great depth of material that requires a lot of time to be invested on the part of the viewer to fully experience the project. As well as the gallery, this material is often documented on the net. Their presentation could therefore be argued to be less visible, at least less visible than the direct statements that were noticeable in the 80s and 90s in the US with the strategies of, for example, political billboard art works, the kind of things that sought to impact upon as wide a public as possible. How important is visibility in socially concerned art?
What I think really is happening is that over the course of the last 10 years or somewhat less perhaps, a lot of artists with social intentions have shifted their space of operations to the internet. The problem there is that the work does lose a certain kind of direct visibility outside the company of artists and net-involved people. But because the nature of the internet as a public sphere is changing and mutating and developing, it's very hard to know how much effect work on the net will actually have in the near term. So it's true that, for one thing, there's been a lot less support in the form of public grants to do work that's literally on the streets or in the public eye. On the other hand, you know, the internet is cheap and easy, so people can do it on their own or ensemble.
So the next interview is with Elio Gilardi. Elio is a member of the creative group of the political activist group Torino Disobbediente. They were known for some time as the Pink Group as opposed to the Black Bloc. And they tried to take a strategy of making more of a carnival atmosphere at protests. So my first question for Elio, can you think of any songs that somehow either helped shape your own political consciousness or were a good reflection of your existing views?
I mean, at the moment, the creative group that was born in Genoa, that changed a bit his method is practice, and at the moment we're doing samba. And so that's samba was born in Brazil, between the slaves and as a protest method, staying in the square, in the street. So that's one of the reasons because we're doing that. So I can't imagine any other songs than samba that it's really that could be really communicative and could join people and it could be politics, it could be action, it could be everything. So we found out that at the moment, doing samba is and playing samba, so playing the songs of samba, is a good way to do politics, and for me it means doing action, being an activist.
What do you think of traditional protest songs where the lyrics are full of poetic or even direct political commentary or reflection, or are trying to encourage people to take some political action?
We don't play that anymore. I mean, they're not really so strong at the moment to involve people, to make people feel, to act, to participate. So at the moment, I don't think they're really so important in my life at the moment, not so strong. I mean, they're good to playing in your house, but it's not activist anymore.
But Italian traditions are strong in this field, and there's this huge tradition of cantatori with its very powerful and popular songs with more or less direct political content. Have these songs ever been used for activist purposes or sung together at demos?
As you said, in Italy this was a big movement, big groups of cantautori from the liberation war in 1945.
Ciao, bella, ciao, bella, ciao, 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 partigiano, portami via, che mi sento di morire.
So we still play these songs, and from that moment on, there have always been people playing the history of the movement, and they are really a strong consciousness of the history of the liberation war and the movement that came after that. So in the last few years, every single demonstration, there were a track with a sound system, and we always used to play these songs. So we still remember that, and somehow we still use that, and people still feel something when hear them these songs. So this tradition is not over. I mean, it's still strong.
I think the fact that you consider samba to be a good way of demonstrating might be a sign of a big change in the attitude of people towards political actions, as I suppose that samba is not based on the content, but much more on the capacity of music to create a community or to make people feel good together.
You're right. It's much more a method. It's much more a practice. Much more a music that make you feel the revolution inside you, you can say. Mm-hmm. It's much more a practice. That's completely different compared to our tradition of revolutionary songs.
Or is that to say it's not about that kind of revolution anymore?
It's about a way to express yourself, of being creative. Creative, doing politics. It's the songs we used to listen was a method to feel a part of an history, part of a big group, that everybody listened to the same songs and everybody feel the same feeling of being revolutionary people. And samba is a way of communicating with other people, it's a way of staying together, it's a way of being creative, and because it's not just samba, it's action with samba. So it's a different things. It's a different way to stay, to express, to stay in a demonstration, mm-hmm. and to doing things. And as the disobedience did before, a few years ago, it's a different way to set up the theater of the conflict with the police. It's even important for our lives, because we have to change even our life and our way to doing this conflict. One thing must be clear. The disobedience are a big group, national group. There's a lot of other small groups. We are just a small group that are related with disobedience. We are not the disobedience. Mm-hmm. So I'm just talking about my experience at the moment. But the disobedience strategies and so on are and other things. And as I told you, they are thinking about the level of violence, the level of communication, conflict, and strategies in different countries and so on. So it's different if we are talking about samba, that's just my small groups, the small creative group that I'm involved in at the moment.
In creating a situation in the street that grabs public attention, you use props, and being the prop maker of the Torino Disobbediente, quite a lot of these props have been made by you, and a lot of the actions of the Disobbediente have the appearance of what are important performance actions in art history. I'm just wondering how you see that in relation to a history of politically motivated performance in contemporary art, or if you're familiar with the actions inspired by the Situationists, whether you consider your activism to be a kind of socially engaged art practice.
Well, I don't know so much of the history of art, but sure I could say that there was, especially in the 60s and 70s, there was a real attention by the artists to the social problems and doing art in the street. I think the art from then are still in the street, so you can do some creativity more spread out, you can express your creativity between the other people, and you express your feeling of art, of being an artist.
So the next interview is with Ross Birrell. Ross is a Glasgow-based artist and lecturer of historical and critical studies at Glasgow School of Art. He is also a sometime musician. So, Ross, to what extent do you feel songs can be political?
I suppose that depends on either the specific content of a song, but sometimes a song can become political or politicised through its appropriation by a specific movement or in dealing with a specific context. I think also that those contexts are open, so I think anything can become potentially politicised, can be turned against its own meaning. So you can play something which in one context is taken straight, in another context it may be ironised. I can't think of a specific example at the moment, but I think the potential is always there for either artwork or music to be recontextualised and politicised in a different way. And also artists and musicians do the same with aspects of culture in general. So one argument could be that all art and all music is political regardless of its specific content, because it's produced either in a capitalist society or that it's funded or supported by a particular class or market or whatever. So you can't escape politics from that particular point of view. But I think that's a structural analysis of the economic production of art and culture and music in late capitalist Western societies. Now, there's a little thing by Jacques Attali, who wrote a book called Noise, The Political Economy of Music, which I think he says something interesting. He says, music is a herald for changes inscribed in noise faster than it transforms society. Listening to music is listening to all noise, realising that its appropriation and control is a reflection of power that is essentially political. His is quite a strong economically driven analysis of the production of music, and it's, I think his book's about 20 years old or something like that now, but I think there are positions out there which have been articulated quite clearly where music can be a source for political reaction, but more importantly where it can be a source for political change and transformation, and how the definitions of music can be challenged, and what constitutes music is actually maybe more political than kind of a political song. You know, to challenge what constitutes music in our culture can be equally political than writing a political protest song in a traditional folk genre. Or somebody like Cage is experimenting with sound in a very formalist environment, and his politics resides in his aesthetics. He says he's an anarchist for the liberation of noise. The self-determination of sound and noise is Cage's kind of principle. So it is an aesthetic principle, but that's where his politics resides. And fair enough, you know. I don't necessarily see it that way. I don't come from that kind of purist thing about it. I don't frame it in that way, and I suppose aesthetics have to be framed in some respect. So,
do you think that political songs actually have an impact on people in shaping their political consciousness, or they just reaffirm existing values and views?
Definitely. I think songs that appeal to a broad sentiment for change, like Lennon's songs like Give Peace a Chance or Power to the People, simplistic, sloganistic songs, which are actually heartfelt emotions that can be chanted in any context, then they do definitely create an atmosphere where change or the potential for change becomes realisable and therefore gives spirit to a movement. I think all movements or all protest movements or all political forces for change need to have an old-fashioned thing called morale and an idea that an ideal can be realised, or else what's the point in getting involved in social action? Having said that, there is still a context in which protest songs are produced and that they are an appeal for change, but they also appeal to a market. So they are recorded, packaged and sold by an artist as a commodity in a particular market. So even though you are appealing to a broad-based collective notion of change, you still have a notion of an individual creative subject, which is actually a reproduction of a subjectivity which is actually appealing to a capitalist consumerist market. So there is a contradiction latent, I think, within that position. But both, I think, are effective in their fields. One is effective for a broad collective social change when it's performed in the street, and another one is effective in producing a valuable commodity which maybe suggests that the person who's buying it is attuned to social resistances or political movements outside their bedroom. But they also effectively produce lots of money for the for people at Lennon. But I mean, that's 20 odd years ago.
The flesh you so fancifully fried, the meat in your mouth as you savour the flavour of murder.
Think of some examples of songs that change people's behaviour in some way. For example, The Smiths' Meat Is Murder or Minor Threat's Straight Edge. Do you think that these kind of changes are just a part of forming an identity along with a pop group, or examples that songs can succeed in inspiring some small changes?
I suppose there is a relationship between pop and proselytising. They can be effective in single-issue-based politics or affecting lifestyle changes, particularly, I suppose, if you are an adolescent and you're trying to assert difference. Pop music is a conventional way that people do that. It's also where you assert your economic difference because you're buying a particular commodity which situates you different from either your school friends or your parents, and that can come down to choices of vegetarianism and other things, I suppose. But personally, I wouldn't proselytise about being against alcohol, drugs or meat. But that's just me and Morrissey. So I suppose the slogan by Jenny Holzer, that abuse of power comes as no surprise, it comes to mind when you think about pop stars taking the stage and peddling their tuppence worth in relation to politics. I mean, there was a recent example in the anti-war protests and the marches and that were organised by, I think it was Damon Albarn from Blur and some guy from Massive Attack. When you listen to the actual political analysis that was involved, it was actually quite weak and slogan-led, but having said that, there was at least an insistence upon organisation, and at least they had access to the media, which was a kind of feedback. So there is a role to be played, but I think we have to guard against ego continuously.
At some other strategies, some bands like The Clash, even with singles high in the music charts, always refuse to play on Top of the Pops. Their absence implied a rejection of establishment pop culture that I could relate to, but as a big fan I remembered that I would still have loved to have seen them appear in amongst the vacuousness of the other acts.
It's an old one, like, I don't think Lennon ever played Top of the Pops. Clash, too. I mean, I think there's a certain nobility in that position, that kind of purist, antagonistic position to blatant consumerism and commercialisation of creativity in mainstream capitalist culture. Obviously that takes place, but at the same time it's one of those things that when you come home from school you would stick on Top of the Pops in the hope that some band, Echo and the Bunnymen or something like that, were on it that you could identify with, that were playing something remotely akin to what you were attuned to. So the retreat from that space, which is actually a communicative space, yeah, and that it has a market in every living room in the land, to not take that stage is problematic as well. Whether you attack from the outside or you attack from the inside, I suppose like the KLF would be a primary example of a group who tried to implode the music industry from the inside at the same time as making a lot of money. But when they entered into the art world and the K Foundation, they tried to attack it from the outside. Both strategies, I think, were equally futile, but at the same time, it was very entertaining watching them do it. It was like this feedback system where it showed the system to itself, but to the viewers and the audience at the same time. I think the real thing is about audience, because what you're talking about when you're talking about buying a guitar or whatever instrument it is, or buy a couple of decks, it moves you from a notion of audience and consumer to a producer of your own culture. And that means finding your voice and articulating your voice. So even if you emulate another voice at that age, I think that's fine. It's about production of your culture and rather than consumption of it, and any means or mode or mechanisation which enables that or a catalyst towards that, I think, is the first step. If you can transform the culture around you, then you can transform the society around you.
The union is behind us, we shall not be moved. The union is behind us, we shall not be moved. Just like a tree that's standing by the water,
what do you think about the role of the traditional protest song in relation to contemporary pop music?
Well, I suppose first of all we have to acknowledge that protest songs aren't popular music. If they weren't popular, then they wouldn't be effective as protest songs. And that then introduces a dialectic between a protest song as opposition and protest song as a commodity for consumption in the market. So if a protest song is antagonistic towards capitalism, say something like Billy Bragg or John Lennon or a whole host of protest songs or bands which set themselves up as antagonistic, I suppose like Chumbawamba in Britain or Public Enemy or something like that, which are antagonistic towards a particular cultural condition, then they are on the one hand antagonistic and on the other hand they are commodities with the market, so they are popular music. But the singing of protest songs collectively on a march is not bought and sold as a commodity, it's a shared experience. So some of these have roots to folk music tradition, something which is actually quite conservative but has subversive potentials. So this idea of a collective folk song actually stands outside the apparatus of capitalism, and its real relationship is not to the commodity but to the gift and to exchange and to a legacy, something that's freely exchanged. It appeals to this logic of the gift, and that I think is a potential source for change.
The next interview is with Jeff Farina. Jeff is the singer, songwriter and guitarist with the band Karate.
Kids come across a solemn and lost, I know, old man evoke last wars and holocausts. German kids, Croatian kids, just like American kids, we know.
To what extent do you feel that songs can be political?
To a great extent. I think that, you know, in the past I've been able to homogenize an idea maybe that a lot of people are thinking but they're not sure how to express, so maybe they might hear it in a song and they kind of rally around that song. I think that's the function it's had in the past. It's a way for maybe people to collectively organize their thoughts on an issue, and I think that's a positive thing. I think it's an important function of music.
Do you think that political songs can actually have an impact on people in shaping their political consciousness, or do they just reaffirm existing views and values?
Well, I think they help people articulate existing views and values. I think that they're a way for people to simplify and be able to make more tangible their own ideas. You know, for example, in the 60s, a lot of those songs, like Dylan's song, you know, I think people like my father or people of that generation sort of said, yeah, you know, this is really what I'm feeling, and were able to use that as like a direct voice and a representation to other people with other ideas. So I think that's a really very important political function of those kinds of songs.
I can think of some songs that within my experience and lifetime changed people's behaviour. For example, The Smiths' Meat Is Murder. After that, a lot of friends of mine became vegetarian, also me around that time. Another would be Minor Threat's Straight Edge, which didn't affect anyone in my closer circle, but I know there were a lot of people who went along with those ideas. Do you think that these changes are symptomatic of the forming of an identity along with the band, like the way that people might have followed the fashions of someone like David Bowie through his different phases, and it doesn't matter that it's anything political, or do they show that there's a possibility of making small changes to people's political consciousness?
I think it's great when maybe a song brings people to question their own practices and to answer honestly and say, I want to do this, or I want to not do this. But I'm not sure that that's always the case with things like straight edge and vegetarianism. I think that a lot of times it becomes fashionable. Where I grew up, you know, in the 80s, there was a huge straight edge scene. I'm not sure how much of it was out of people's concern for the environment or for their bodies. I think it was more about being part of something. And so that's always kind of a sad thing when those beliefs are kind of taken over by fad or something, which I think happens a lot. But on the other hand, if there's music that really gets people to practice their behavior, or maybe, you know, the example of the Smiths, maybe a lot of people said, well, you know, here's a group of people who have already made a decision that I want to make, which is not to eat meat. And so therefore the song sort of is a way to pose the question to themselves and question their own practices. And I think that's great. I mean, I think that's a really great function. You know, it's a rare thing. I think those two examples are really rare, you know, considering how much music's made, but...
Have you ever considered that strategy in your own work?
I could never do it. I could never do it. I mean, you know, I don't know that much about the Smiths, but, you know, Ian has, like, an incredibly strong personality and very polarized opinions about things, and I don't have those things. I think that it takes a certain kind of performer or a composer to kind of represent things as being that polarized. And I could never... I don't think that my music or the way that I approach music is conducive to that at all. I think my music is more something that might present a situation and present more of a question than sort of like a didactic message or something. So,
can you think of any of your own songs that are more political than others?
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot... I think, you know, songs like Ice or Ground or... well, there's a lot of new songs on the new record that are very... that would be considered, you know, by genre, political, I think, with a capital P.
There's a recent song that is about taking a ride with a truck driver after a breakdown.
Yeah, it's about... that's on the new record. It's a song about... it's actually, you know, a true story of when my car broke down and I got picked up by somebody who was driving a tow truck, and he expressed his intolerant views of people coming to America to me, and sort of to the point where we got in an argument about it. So those songs are really directly political. You know, the idea of political and personal, that dichotomy, I don't think is always true. I mean, I think there's a lot of songs that maybe love songs or kind of personal songs that actually have a political effect. bringing a lot of people who have similar feelings or similar ways of dealing with certain things together. And, you know, that's what the word political means. I mean, if bringing, you know, homogenizing a certain group of people around an idea or something. So, you know, I think a lot of my songs are, they're not political in the sense of a crass song, or, you know, I'm not the type of person who sits up there and kind of preaches or condemns something at point blank. I think it's more I try to present a situation and maybe raise a question that people may have not thought of, or present a scenario that maybe people didn't think of, something like that.
One contributor to the protest songbook suggested that there was something essentially political in the act of young people deciding to pick up guitars and do something, grouping together to form a band, because then in a sense you're moving from being a consumer of culture to being a producer of your own culture.
Sure. I think that's true to an extent. I mean, it's true in a vacuum. I think that now there's, you know, so many bands and so many people making music, there, it's also, you know, I think that there's also this idea of consumption when you're in a band, because you're being part of, you're consuming this kind of idea of being, you know, living a commodified kind of rock star type of lifestyle or something like that. And I think that a lot of people kind of get into that. It's you know, all these bands that sound like Gang of Four or The Cure or whatever, this, you know, 100 bands that just jump into that every year and kind of get this preconceived thing going and become famous and then break up, and next year there's another band that's exactly like them. And I think, you know, I would question whether that's at all political. I think that's actually, being in producing music like that, you know, it's now commercial music, and I think it's a form of consumption or sort of regurgitating these same aesthetic ideas over and over again or something. But I think there's also a lot of, you know, a lot of bands, they're doing something that's genuinely concerned with the music, and they're just pushing music forward in a new way. And I think people who are really interested in the music and not the fashion will kind of gather around those bands.
Quite often bands that don't have a particularly political content to their lyrics or music, when they become quite successful, they're in a position where they can command a great audience, and they try to use that position to make a statement. I'm thinking, for example, of Michael Stipe or Bono or the singer of Blur, who was making some big statements before the anti-war rally in London. Do you think there's a value in that?
I think, yes, it's important. I think if you have the chance to speak to 500,000 people, you should say something constructive, you know, something that's going to help people to, you know, find their own opinions or be active in society. Because as long as they're, you know, real human political ideas and not just, you know, jump up and down and cheer nationalistic ideas or something. So, you know, crowd consciousness can also be really a fascist kind of thing, you know, to get everybody to think the exact same thought or something. I think it's, you know, it's important for people to think for themselves and be critical of everything.
What do you think about the role of traditional protest songs in relation to contemporary pop music? I'm thinking of the old style of protest song being like Dylan, Woody Guthrie, or even Lennon's Give Peace a Chance, a kind of sloganistic, anthemic song that can be sung with an acoustic guitar at protest rallies. There's not much of that around these days. Maybe that's the result of music having changed to being a lot more complex technically, relying on sampled sounds or elaborate electronic beats, but being difficult to reproduce spontaneously at a protest. Do you think there's a comparison to be made between today's music scene and its politicization and the previous generation?
Well, first of all, you know, the idea of like chanting sloganistic songs, personally, that's not, to me, a very powerful or interesting form of being political as an artist, because I think that any kind of fanaticism is a little scary. I mean, any kind of large group of people who are maybe chanting the exact same idea or something like that, I guess I really question that, and I don't see political action now as being the same as it was in the 60s or in the 20s or something. I think it's more important to get people to think critically about their own ideas, and they might not always be the same, but they might be able to come together the same, you know, on a certain point or something. So as for the role of music, I mean, you know, a lot of that stuff from the 60s, I guess I question its musical value. I think it had much more political value than, you know, I don't know that you put it on and listen to it as a piece of art. It's more of a, I don't know, more of like a folk practice or something. You know, there's other examples. I mean, Dylan's Tears of Rage, for example.
Tears of rage, tears of grief. Why am I always the one who must be the thief? Come to me now, you know it.
An incredible song that's questions sort of this like devotion to America, but then why isn't it, you know, asks why isn't the flag here to protect me when I was there to, you know, for my country. And it does it in a very subtle, complex way. It's not just chanting no war. I mean, it does it in a way that the lyrics have a lot of depth, and as a song, it's a beautiful song and tells a story and has a narrative. And I think those kinds of songs, regardless of what they're about, they stand up artistically and musically, but they also function as, you know, kind of a rallying piece of art or rallying music.
Yeah.
And I personally have a lot more interest in those kinds of songs than like Jet Lennon's Give Peace a Chance, which I just think is a, you know, protest marching kind of thing. I think that's what, you know, Dylan was just really, you know, a master at, was putting these ideas into narratives. And
have you been able to think of a song that you could mention for the protest songbook?
Sure, a lot of songs. Like I said, definitely, you know, Tears of Rage, that Dylan song. Mm. There was a band when I was growing up called Beefeater that was a really big influence on me. And, you know, a lot of Minutemen songs, definitely.
Something making a beach, something trash. American trash, you must could ruin a good time.
We're actually doing a In the Fish Tank session up in Holland in a couple of weeks. We're actually covering a lot of political songs that were critical of America. Everything from like Strange Fruit, the old Billie Holiday song about race relations.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
To like some Minutemen songs and a Beefeater song. And we're doing Tears of Rage, the Dylan song. So those are kind of what's in my head right now, I think. The reason we chose to do it, I think, was, you know, part of it was because living in America, I think we've become more and more critical of our country. And certainly, you know, I've written more political songs recently than I have in the past. And I think it's something that's just interested me personally. And I just wanted to kind of go back to a lot of these great songs that had an influence on me and that were really critical of America in, I think, smart ways, you know. And some of them are amazing, like the Minutemen songs, they could have been written yesterday. Like one of the lyrics is, saw some military hardware today, olive drab has changed to brown, yellow, and gray. And it's just, you know, completely applicable to you know, America's role in the Middle East right now.
So now I'll just read out some of the contributions that we received from the call for entries to the protest songbook. So people have suggested a song and gave a reason why they felt that song impacted on them in some political sense. Michael Albert from the USA suggested Subterranean Homesick Blues by Bob Dylan.
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on a pavement thinking about the government. The man in a trench coat, bad job laid off, says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off. Look out, kid, it's something you did. God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway looking for a new friend. The man in a coonskin cap in a pig pen wants $11 bills. You only got 10.
He wrote of it. When I was coming of age, as they say, it was a time of great cultural ferment. The music of the 60s profoundly impacted my life. So many songs and artists. Most influential, however, was Bob Dylan. There are too many songs to list, but if I have to pick one, as you request, I will pick two. Subterranean Homesick Blues, which I listened to over and over to decipher and learn the words. They are still with me, of course. Give it a listen. If only people understood it fully, even now. And then, When the Ship Comes In. It couldn't be more obvious, could it?
Oh, the time will come up when the winds will stop and the breeze will cease to be breathing, like the stillness in the wind before the hurricane begins. The hour that the ship comes in and the sea will...
Carlo from Leipzig suggested Whitey on the Moon by Gil Scott-Heron.
A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the Moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know, the man just upped my rent last night, 'cause Whitey's on the moon. No hot water, no toilets, no lights, but Whitey's on the moon. I wonder why he's upping me.
He said of it, "The first track which sprang to mind for me was Whitey on the Moon by Gil Scott-Heron. On hearing this as a kid, and now a grown-up kid, it made me realise that there was more options out there than the general party line. And now that nothing much has changed and the struggle for basic needs for all continues, the priorities of the power elite still keep us apart."
With all that money I made last year for Whitey on the Moon, how come I ain't got no money here? Whitey's on the moon. You know, I just about had my fill of Whitey on the moon. I think I'll send these doctor bills. Air mail special. To Whitey on the Moon.
Tracy Whiteley of Budapest in Hungary suggested the song Bloody Revolutions by the band Crass. She said about it, "The idea got me quite nostalgic. I remember a song called Bloody Revolutions by the early Brit punk group Crass, from the days when punk was punk and being an anti-fashion statement wasn't enough. The song Bloody Revolutions was one of the slower romantic numbers."
You talk about revolution, oh that's fine, but what are you going to be doing come the time? You're gonna be the big man, the Tommy Gun. We talk of freedom when the blood begins to run. Freedom has no value, it finances the price. So I want your revolution, I want anarchy and peace. You talk about buying power.
It was brilliant sitting in the Fox Hunt Saboteurs van, eating sandwiches with mushroom patty on them, and singing these kind of songs with 30 other wet, muddy and enthusiastic punks and hippies, determined to save not only the fox, but the world from the type of people who go fox hunting. It was as much class war as it was animal liberation. The next part that means something to me is, "But what of all those people who don't agree with you? Those who have their own convictions? You say they've got it wrong because they don't agree with you, so when the revolution comes, you'll have to run them through." Well, I guess that was the wake-up part. I always thought of this in a historical sense, the butchering of the sailors at Kronstadt, for example, by Trotsky. I remember the running them through could be a metaphor for any way of putting down those who disagree with you, buying them, isolating them, keeping them in housing schemes, giving them Valium. In the face of the dominant ideology, that ideology is dead, disagreeing these days seems more likely to be put down to dysfunctional genes or not having worked hard enough to be a success or having had a bad childhood. There doesn't seem as much hope around as there was 20 years ago. Mariana Vons from Edinburgh in Scotland suggested The Ballad of Sacco and Vanzetti by Joan Baez.
Against us is the law with its immensity of strength and power. Against us is the law. Police know how to make a man a guilty or an innocent. Against us is the power of police. The shameless lies that men have told will evermore be paid in gold. instances the racial hatred and the simple fact that we're poor.
She said about it, "It's not my favourite political song, but it's the first one I remember. My mum explained the story to me and I was very upset to find out that even with such great international support, Sacco and Vanzetti were still executed. At that age, 8 I think, I was already aware that American were the ones who slaughtered the Native Americans. But hearing the story made me even more suspicious of the so-called democracy of the US." Oliver Schneider from Berlin in Germany suggested Kerosene by the band Big Black. He wrote about it, "It wasn't the lyrics so much that impressed me at the age of 15. It was the strange guitar sound that sounded more like a tearing steel rope than an electric guitar that I knew from Status Quo or Slade. That sound could drive you wild, but in a way that has also a pessimistic attitude that doesn't lead the aggression from the inside to the outside. It's the moment right before the explosion, or a still picture of it. Set me on fire, Kerosene. But the lyrics were also perfect for English beginners. What a dark hymn. My hometown of Folkingen was beginning to die at that time. The government decided not to support the iron and steel industry anymore, and thousands of workers were disengaged. So the city was becoming a ghost town with enormous rusty industrial complexes that still formed the atmosphere inside the city. Sometimes the sky was yellow during the day, orange at night, and the cars were covered with an inch thick layer of dust. Probably I forgot most of the boredom we had as kids. Times that had nothing special are hard to remember, aren't they? Never anything to do in this town. Lived here my whole life. After listening to mainstream pop and rock music in the early 80s, that sound was a revolution for me. All that noise. I remember visiting my best friend at his place when I was opening the door to his room and this unbelievable burst of noise coming out. It was Psycho Candy by the Jesus and Mary Chain. I'm not sure that noise or pure sound can be a political statement, but it definitely had an effect on me. But noise can have two almost opposite effects. It's like listening to Merzbow, a contemporary Japanese noise artist, for an hour. Either you're about to destroy the hi-fi set, or you'll be losing yourself in a psychedelic maelstrom. And then Oliver quotes Guy Debord saying, "Boredom is always counter-revolutionary." Susan George of Attack in France suggested Woody Guthrie's Union Maid.
Union Maid was wise to the tricks of the company spies. She'd never be fooled by a company stool. She'd always organize the guys. She'd always get her way when she asked for better pay. She'd show her card to the National Guard, and this is what she'd say: "Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking with the Union. I'm sticking with the Union. I'm sticking with the Union. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking with the Union. I'm sticking with the Union till the day I go."
She said about it, "Woody Guthrie is the greatest American singer protester. I'm especially thinking of the one whose chorus goes, 'Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the Union, I'm sticking to the Union till the day I die.' The guitar work is great too. You can do it with one or several and sing the song solo or in parts." Mark Wilson from Scotland suggested Southern Man by Neil Young.
Southern man, better keep your head.
of it that it's angry, passionate, and an ironic call for overdue reform and abandonment of racism in the deep south of the USA. Jeremiah Day from Amsterdam in Holland suggested Suggestion by Fugazi.
Is my body my only trade? In the eyes of men, in the eyes of men.
Of it, first of all quoting the lyrics, suffer your ways, your minds, your hands, suffer your interpretations of what it is to be a man. Fugazi have slogans, you are not what you own, and Fugazi have principles, no interviews with magazines that advertise alcohol or tobacco, all ages cheap shows, no alcohol, and that is what makes them political. They have refused to be subsumed within consumerism, and they have groaned and yelled and protested. But what has made Fugazi a crucial part of my life for 10 years is the ability of their music to resurrect the defeated part of me and challenge the oppressive clichés about the way the world is. What it is to be a man is the space from which all challenges begin, from what Foucault called the fascism of everyday life, where we are taught to aspire to the terms of power that destroy us, to the idea that all politics is inherently a dirty endgame of mendacity and interest. DC hardcore, punk music from Washington DC, was marked by a do-it-yourself experimental practice that is essential, that in essence is political. Though Fugazi never got involved with parties or elections, they have continually spoken and acted as if they had the right to affect the conditions of the world around them, and it's contagious, this energy. What we have all surrendered to, corrupt dictators in the USA or bureaucratic administration in Europe, is exactly that, our inherent possibility to claim and participate in the public realm around us. Protest is inadequate. We are not on the outside looking in. The old banner, another world is possible, is plainly wrong. We only have this one. It is ours. We must claim it in action by each of affirmatively building new structures, challenging the corrupt ones and resisting. And it hurts, it's hard, and your anger is legitimate. Your outrage is proof that you've not been reduced to a numbered automaton. That's what Fugazi means to me. Ian Ramsey from Edinburgh in Scotland suggested the revolution will not be televised by Gil Scott-Heron.
The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner. The revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run, or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on reports from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still lifes of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he had been saving for just the right occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so goddamn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally screwed Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised.
There will be no. He wrote, it's difficult to pinpoint exactly why this political song meant so much to me. A combination of the satire on how television affects society, how media controls our lives, a warning against apathy, and for a political song, a pretty funky tune. At the time of its release, this really was a pretty revolutionary recording, a call for action, to be watchful, not to be hoodwinked or appeased by what was on the television at the time. Times have, however, changed, and any revolution these days would not only be televised, available on a vast majority of channels 24 hours a day, there would be a fair chance you would be paying in some way to view it. That said, anything truly revolutionary, in a non-media friendly sense, i.e. not involving petrol bomb throwing hordes, will probably be avoided by the media. The anti-globalisation and anti-war movements, amongst others, will always be distanced, controlled at arm's length by the vast majority of the media. This song went on to be an inspiration for the rap movement, and the likes of Scott Heron and The Last Poets are widely regarded as the precursors of the genre. Andreas Fogarashi of Vienna in Austria suggested My Metro Card by Le Tigre. He simply quoted a line from the song, which was, "Fuck Giuliani, he's such a fucking jerk." Lisa Armstrong from California in the USA suggested Fuck and Run by Liz Phair. She said, "This song talks to me about how men use women for sex, but it's how it's so ingrained in the culture that women just buy into it, even though it hurts them because they feel they have no choice. This social idea needs to change." Zuki Serper, who lives in Germany, I think, suggested Bella Ciao. It's a traditional Italian partisan song. Una mattina mi son svegliato, oh bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Una mattina mi son svegliato ed ho trovato l'invaso. Oh partigiano, portami via, oh bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Partigiano, portami via, che mi sento di morire. Since Genova in 2001, the Italian partisan song Bella Ciao has become an unofficial hymn at anti-capitalist events. The best experience I had was at the final session of the European Social Forum in Florence in November 2002. The song marked the end of the day of discussions and arguments amongst the social movements, and it resulted with the call for a general strike and demonstrations on the day of the war, the day that the war in Iraq started, and an all-European-wide demonstration on February 15th, 2003. As you probably remember, the call from Florence evolved to the Global Day of Action on February 15th, and the biggest social movement in world history. I think that the song Bella Ciao represents this spirit and hope. Mi diranno che bel fiore, e questo è il fiore del partigiano. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. E questo è il fiore del partigiano, morto per la libertà. E questo è il fiore del partigiano. That was an example of some of the contributions we received for this, the protest songbook. You can read more of them at a website where all of the interviews and contributions are documented, and the web address is www.bighope.hu/protestsongbook. That's all one word. So I'd like to end now by thanking everyone who contributed a song and a text for this protest songbook, and also thanking Martha Rossler, Elio Gilardi, Ross Burrow and Jeff Farina for doing an interview with us and contributing their ideas on the topic. I'd also like to thank you for listening. Elvis was a hero to most, but Elvis was a hero to most. Elvis was a hero to most, but he never meant to me. Is he straight out racist? The sucker was simple and plain. Motherf*** you mean John Wayne? Cause I'm black and I'm proud. Already. I'm ready, I'm hyped, cause I'm amped. Most of my heroes don't appear in no stamp. Sample, look back, you looking. This has been the Protest Songbook, a project by Hungarian artist Miklos Erhardt and myself, Dominic Hislop. We work together under the group name Big Hope. You can find more of our projects online at www.bighope.hu. We got to fight the powers that be.